the peak productivity actually fell off at a little bit less than 40 hours a week. Armed with this data, Scott started to send people home early. "It took them a while to get that I was serious," said Scott, "but eventually they came around to my way of thinking." He started telling people that working late wasn't a sign of commitment, it was a sign of failure. "It's not because I want you to have a balanced life," he told people. "It's because you'll get more stuff done." So no more nights, no more weekends. When people go on vacation, they're expected to go on vacation, not check email, not check in with the office. If you can't actually take time off without having to make sure everything is going right at the office, the thinking goes, you aren't managing your teams well. A lot of companies don't practice work hour limits, says Scott, but there is a direct correlation. You get more done, you are happier, and you have higher quality. It's a no-brainer. Working less helps you get more done with higher quality. Scott says the curve is different for different people, even for the same person at different times in their lives. "I've noticed, as I've gotten older and in different roles, that the peak output for me is at a lower number of hours than it was 20 years ago," he says. Physical fitness, diet, personal issues, and other factors all play a role, he thinks. But he also believes that his output reaches its peak faster as he has grown and thought quite deeply about how to work. "I've been able to attack more and more important impact opportunities." Why is it that if you work fewer hours, you get more done? It doesn't really seem to make sense on the face of it. Scott says that people who work too many hours start making mistakes, which, as we've seen, can actually take more effort to fix than to create. Overworked employees get more distracted and begin distracting others. Soon, they're making bad decisions. John Katzenbach's instincts were right. The disturbing evidence reveals that we have a very limited capability to make decisions, and the more energy depleted we are and the less downtime we get, the worse we are at it. In April of 2011, a group of Israeli researchers published some remarkable research about decision-making in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America. Their paper, titled "Extraneous Factors in Judicial Decisions," looked at over 1,000 judicial rulings by 8 Israeli judges who presided over 2 different parole boards. The rulings covered Jewish Israeli and Arab Israeli criminals, both men and women. The crimes ranged from embezzlement and assault to murder and rape. The vast majority of the decisions the judges looked at were requests for parole. It seems fairly straightforward, right? These are esteemed judges using their years of experience and wisdom to make critical decisions affecting not only the lives of the prisoners and their victims, but the well-being of the community as a whole. Each day, they heard between 14 and 35 cases. So if you were a prisoner, what was the biggest factor in whether you'd go free or not? True remorse, perhaps? Your reformation and behavior in prison? The severity of your crime? None of those, actually. It turns out what really mattered was how long it had been since the judge had had a sandwich. The researchers looked at what time judges made decisions, whether clemency was granted, and how long it had been since the judges had had a snack. If they'd just gotten to work, or back from a snack break, or back from lunch, they made favorable decisions more than 60% of the time. That rate dropped to nearly zero by the time of the next break. Basically, right after a short break, judges came in with a more positive attitude and made more lenient decisions. They displayed more imagination and capacity to see that the world and people could change, could be different. But as they burned up their reserves of energy, they began to make more and more decisions that maintained the status quo. I'm sure that if you asked these judges if they were certain they were making equally good decisions each time, they'd be affronted. But numbers and sandwiches don't lie. When we don't have any energy reserves left, we're prone to start making unsound decisions. This phenomenon has been labeled ego depletion. The idea is that making any choice involves an energy cost. It's an odd sort of exhaustion. You don't feel physically tired, but your capacity to make good decisions diminishes. What really changes is your self-control, your ability to be disciplined, thoughtful, and prescient. A fascinating experiment shows just that. A group of researchers wanted to know how making decisions affects self-control. So they gathered the foot soldiers of psychological research, collegiate undergraduates, and had one set of them make a bunch of decisions. Specifically, these students were presented with different products, and asked to choose which they preferred. They were told to think carefully because they'd be given a free gift at the end of the experiment, and their preferences would decide what they'd get. The other set of students had no decisions to make. The test group was asked questions such as, what kind of scented candle do you like, vanilla or almond? What kind of shampoo brand do you prefer? Do you like this candy or that? Then they were given the classic test of self-control. How long can you hold your hand in ice water? Whatever resource is burned up by making decisions is also used up in self-regulation. The students who'd made all the product decisions simply couldn't hold their hands in the icy water as long as the control group that had been spared the decisions. So there's a limited number of sound decisions you can make in any one day. And as you make more and more, you erode your ability to regulate your own behavior. You start making mistakes, eventually serious ones. And as that curve that Scott Maxwell drew shows, those bad decisions impact productivity. So go home at 5, turn off the cell phone over the weekend, watch a movie, perhaps most important, have a sandwich. By not working so much, you'll get more and better work done. Scrum asks those who engage in it to break from the mindset of measuring merely hours. Hours themselves represent a cost. Instead, measure output. Who cares how many hours someone worked on something? All that matters is how fast it's delivered and how good it is. Be reasonable. There are three types of waste identified by Taichi Ono that lead to people working harder and for more hours than necessary. I've just pointed out why that's an incredibly bad idea. But recognizing these types of waste, which Ono called muri, or unreasonableness, is perhaps the most powerful lever for change we can reach. The first is absurdity. You want to give your team challenging goals to push them to reach for more, but you don't want them striving for absurd, impossible goals. The second is unreasonable expectations. How many times have you heard someone brag that through their own heroic efforts they saved a project? Usually, this is greeted with backslaps, cheers, and congratulations. I see this as a fundamental flaw in the process. A team that depends on regular heroic actions to make its deadlines is not working the way it's supposed to work. Constantly moving from one crisis to the next causes burnout, and it doesn't allow for reasoned, continuous improvement. It's the difference between a cowboy riding in and rescuing the girl from the bad guys and a disciplined Marine platoon clearing the kill zone. Ono called the third type of waste overburden. It's the sort of behavior that Scott Adams regularly lampoons in his Dilbert cartoons. It includes onerous company policies that get in the way, unnecessary reporting that has people filling out forms for the sake of filling out forms, and meaningless meetings that suck up time and don't deliver any value. While Ono didn't mention a fourth type of waste, one comes to mind: emotional waste. That type of waste is generated when a company has an asshole in its midst, someone who likes spinning up other people and putting them in a tizzy. Assholes often justify their behavior by claiming they're simply trying to make people work better, but they're merely indulging the negative aspects of their personality, and nothing is more undermining of a team's ability to excel. Don't be an asshole, and don't allow, abet, or accept that behavior in others. Flow. In a theoretically perfect world, there would be no process, no meetings, no forms, no reporting. Instead, there'd be the creation of exactly what the customer wants, even if the customer didn't know they wanted it yet. Any process that people use is wasteful, and that includes Scrum. But we don't live in a perfect world, and bad processes are so ingrained in our thinking that as an alternative, we need the lightest weight process with the greatest impact on work. What Scrum does is focus us on trying to eliminate the pointless waste that seems part and parcel of work. I've tried to make it so that the process itself is the least disturbing framework you can have and still keep people focused. What you really want in your work is effortless flow. In the martial arts or in meditative practice, when you reach a sense of oneness with emotion, it is no longer an effort. It is energy effortlessly flowing through you. When you watch great dancers or singers, you sense they're surrendering to a force greater than themselves as they let their art move through them. Reaching that spot in our work is what we should all seek. But as the kung fu master, the monk, the dancer, or the opera star will tell you, at the root of flow is discipline. There could be no wasted movement, nothing extraneous, just focused application of human capability. Waste is anything that distracts you from that. If you start thinking about work in terms of discipline and flow, you might just do something amazing. The takeaway. Multitasking makes you stupid. Doing more than one thing at a time makes you slower and worse at both tasks. Don't do it. If you think this doesn't apply to you, you're wrong. It does. Half done is not done. A half-built car simply ties up resources that could be used to create value or save money. Anything that's in process costs money and energy without delivering anything. Do it right the first time. When you make a mistake, fix it right away. Stop everything else and address it. Fixing it later can take you more than 20 times longer than if you fix it now. Working too hard only makes more work. Working long hours doesn't get more done, it gets less done. Working too much results in fatigue, which leads to errors, which leads to having to fix the thing you just finished. Rather than work late or on the weekends, work weekdays only at a sustainable pace and take a vacation. Don't be unreasonable. Goals that are challenging are motivators. Goals that are impossible are just depressing. No heroics. If you need a hero to get things done, you have a problem. Heroic effort should be viewed as a failure of planning. Enough with the stupid policies. Any policy that seems ridiculous likely is. Stupid forms, stupid meetings, stupid approvals, stupid standards are just that, stupid. If your office seems like a Dilbert cartoon, fix it. No assholes. Don't be one and don't allow the behavior. Anyone who causes emotional chaos, inspires fear or dread, or demeans or diminishes people needs to be stopped cold. Strive for flow. Choose the smoothest, most trouble-free way to get things done. Scrum is about enabling the most flow possible. Chapter 6. Plan reality, not fantasy. Hey Jeff, we have a problem. That's how a lot of my phone conversations start. People have backed themselves into a corner and they pick up the phone and call me. This time, it was Mark Landy, Medco's chief architect of software. If you get your prescriptions through the mail, you more than likely deal with his company. At the time of this call, Medco was a Fortune 100 firm with nearly $38 billion in revenue, the largest pharmaceutical company in the country with tens of thousands of employees, and their management had just walked them off a cliff. I got the call in December of 2006. That July, their president, Kenny Klepper, had announced to Wall Street his latest idea. Mark Landy described it this way. We were trying to convince more and more people to switch to getting their prescriptions by mail, and there are some barriers to that, barriers such as the appearance of inconvenience. But Mark said there were some ways around it. Look, when you go into a pharmacy, your experience is minimally clinical. You hand over your prescription, sign a waiver saying you don't want to talk to the pharmacist, and walk out. We can improve that experience. One of the things they wanted to do was put a pharmacist on the telephone with the patient, a pharmacist who was familiar not only with the drug being prescribed, but with all the drugs being prescribed to that patient. The latter was particularly important if the patient had a chronic condition, such as diabetes or heart disease, which 80% of the people on regular medication do. And most of those folks, certainly if they're older, are on six or more medications at the same time, and their doctors, specialists in different fields of health, don't always know it. Doctors don't always share information with each other. We, as the pharmacy, know more than the doctors know, and we know it in real time, even before the health insurance plan knows, said Landy. So here was Klepper's idea. Let's create specialized pharmacies in five different sites spread across the country. There'll be the cardiac pharmacy, the diabetes pharmacy, the one for asthma, and so on. And we'll train pharmacists assigned to those sites to be aware of drug interactions, side effects, and so on. And because the pharmacist will have comprehensive insight into the patient's condition, they'll be able to let doctors know when there might be contraindications. Let's say someone is diabetic. they're more likely to be overweight and possibly to have liver issues. As a result, they'll metabolize drugs differently. So if a new doctor prescribes a blood pressure medication, the Medco pharmacist might call the doctor and recommend that he or she run a liver panel on the patient and adjust dosage if need be. The goal was to bring new customers to Medco, which, for the most part, served companies and health insurance plans. By using these new pharmacies, or therapeutic resource centers, customers could save money by cutting not necessarily their prescription costs, but their overall medical costs, which rise when people either don't take their medications properly or take drugs that interact poorly with one another or with that person in particular. What's more, Medco would guarantee the cost savings. If a customer didn't save the amount of money Medco projected, Medco would pick up the difference. Wall Street, to put it mildly, liked this notion. Pretty cool idea, right? Save money and provide better health care. More customers, more sales, win-win. There was only one problem. While Klepper had checked with his managers that the idea was technically possible, he hadn't obtained details on how long this plan would take to implement. The people who would actually make it happen only found out about it after the president had promised Wall Street that the new system would be put in place on July 7th, 2007, come hell or high water. Making that deadline was especially important to Medco because while they'd been the first to start automated mail order pharmacies, they weren't the only ones and their competitors were hungry. Unfortunately, they had a lot of hurdles to leap. For example, much of the software the company relied on to direct their on-site robots was badly outdated. In Medco's 5 gargantuan plants, filled with 4,000 pharmacists processing prescriptions, robots whizzed about pulling pills while other robots handled packaging and mailing, and all those systems had to talk to one another with 100% accuracy or someone could die. The idea was that Klepper's brave new plan would give Medco a chance to update their aging systems and stay a step ahead of their competitors. It took the company nearly 6 months to figure out that they couldn't do it on time. Their calculation showed that, in the best-case scenario, they deliver the system at least 1 year late, probably more. That's when they called me. Why it took them 6 months to figure out that they couldn't do it in time is something that bears examination. It wasn't that they weren't smart, or didn't have the right teams in place, or even the right technology. It wasn't that they weren't working hard or being competitive. You don't get to be the biggest company in your sector without doing all that. It was because they made a very basic mistake. They thought they could plan everything ahead of time. They spent months of effort making the sort of detailed plans that seem plausible, that are laid out on pretty charts and include carefully precise steps and almost always describe a fictional reality. As I've said previously, the very act of planning is so seductive, so alluring, that planning itself becomes more important than the actual plan. And the plan becomes more important than reality. Never forget, the map is not the terrain. When a team first sits down to map out a project, there's often electricity in the room, a sense of possibility, of new worlds to discover and new ideas with which to experiment. It really is one of the best feelings in the world. Then comes that moment when inspiration turns to calculation and some of that energy dissipates. People begin pondering, how do we actually get from point A to point B? And once we figured that out, how long is it going to take? Unfortunately, that calculation phase can be a garbage-in, garbage-out process. The people involved may be highly intelligent, and yet they typically won't realize that what they're feeding into their planning charts is a lot of wishful thinking. When Mark had explained the situation at Medco, I replied, "You do have a problem." I waited a beat, then followed that with, "But I bet we can solve it." Right before Christmas, I flew to New Jersey to spend a day at the company determining the scope of the issue. It was not trivial. There were reams of paper outlining requirements, compliance, all sorts of reports and phase gates and quality assurance. Buried in there somewhere was what actually needed to be done, but no one actually had a plan for how to do it. After meeting with key personnel for a while, I called up Brent Barton, a scrum trainer I'd worked with on other projects. "Brent," I said, "I need you and whomever else you can wrangle by the beginning of January. We've got our work cut out for us." Brent would later describe the Medco he saw when he walked in as a company in deadlock. There were so many interests and people at loggerheads that nothing was getting done. That first day, we met with about 7 different groups of people, each of which owned a piece of the project, and none was really interested in trying something new. But, he says now, we had the luxury of, oh shit. You can use pain and fear as your ally when you walk in as a consultant. When we ran into resistance, we just told them, hey, you can do things the way you're doing them, stick with the status quo, and you'll deliver late, and that'll be fine. And they said, that's not fine. The first thing we did was call everyone into a conference room. All the key players, all the people who'd actually be doing the work. And Brent told everyone to print out all the documents they had describing what needed to be done with the project. No, email wasn't okay. We wanted physical paper. We were in a large room, maybe 50 feet on a side, windowless, as those kinds of rooms mysteriously always seem to be. In the middle was a table where we stacked all the documents that people walked in with a few hours later. The stack was at least 2 feet tall. How many of you have actually read all this? I asked. Silence. But look, I said to one of the managers, you signed off on it. There's your signature. Didn't you actually read it? More awkward silence. I didn't want to pick on him, but the fact is, in project after project, people cut and paste and throw in boilerplate, but no one actually reads all those thousands of pages. They can't. That's the point. They've set up a system that forces them to endorse a fantasy. So Brent and I got out scissors and tape, glue sticks and sticky notes. Turns out you really did learn everything you need to know in kindergarten. Here's what we're going to do, Brent said. We're going to go through these stacks of paper and cut out everything that is actually something that needs to be done to complete this project. Then we're going to stick them on the wall. So over the next couple of hours, that's what people did. At the end, we had hundreds and hundreds of notes lining 3 walls. Still on the table was more than 50% of that 2-foot tower. Duplication, boilerplate, templates. Complete and total waste. Then I said to the teams, now we need to estimate how much work each one of these sticky notes will take. Not how long, but how much work. I'll go into the best ways to do this later in this chapter, since humans are actually awful at estimating work. But I taught them a quick and dirty method that is the best of a whole bunch of bad ways of doing it, and they went at it. It took them a while, but they did it. Up on the wall was everything they needed to do to complete the project, broken down into manageable tasks. And they'd estimated how much effort they thought each one would take. They actually were excited. An unreadable stack of paper had become understandable pieces of work. It's like that old saw, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. One of the key things we did with each sticky note was write down not only what had to be created, but also how we'd know when it was done. That is how we incorporated all the FDA compliance requirements, quality assurance, and process reports they had to be mindful of. We simply said, for this task to be done, it had to meet those goals. We baked that into the project at the work item level, rather than waiting for everything to be done, and then finding out that we weren't in compliance with some federal regulation or internal quality metric. This way, everyone on the team, not only the compliance people, had to work to meet that level of quality first before moving on to the next item. The amount of rework this removes from a project is incredible. I call this standard that must be met a definition of done. Everyone knows when something is done or not. There are clear standards that any piece of work has to meet. Staring at all those sticky notes on the wall, everyone had a feeling of accomplishment. They could now see what they had to do. Okay, said Brent. What do we need to do first? About 5 people spoke up. And then? Another 5 people, with different ideas this time. And then? What we wanted them to do was something that, at times, no one really wants to do. Prioritize the work. Often people simply say, everything is important. But what he was asking was, what will bring the most value to the project? Let's do those things first. At the end, we had 6 different rows of sticky notes on the walls, each a different color representing a different team. The lists stretched the length of 3 sides of the room. Now I knew we could at least begin. Wedding planning. It may sound simple when I put it that way, but let me illustrate the steps in the process by using an example that is smaller in scale, a wedding. A formal wedding is a project with a lot of things that have to be done by a particular date, and as you know, if you've gotten married, or will discover if you do decide to wed, everything will go wrong and will take 4 times the effort you anticipated. Of course, it can go the other way too. Something that you think will take hours gets banged out in 15 minutes. The ever-plaguing question is, why are we so terrible at estimating how long something will take? And boy, are we bad. We'll get to that wedding in a moment, but first let me introduce you to an idea with one of the best names ever. The cone of uncertainty. Basically, it graphs how accurate estimates are over the life of a project. As you can imagine, at the beginning, the estimates vary and get closer and closer to right as the project nears completion. What you might not guess is how bad those estimates are at the beginning. They can vary from 400% bigger than the real number to 25% of the amount of work the project actually took in the end. That's a factor of 16. The best you can possibly get with traditional estimation just isn't that much better than a wild-ass guess. Think back to Medco. They spent months planning their effort, what the product would look like, how long it would take. And even after all those months, the research shows that they were likely to be off by as much as a factor of 4 either way. Which is why, in my opinion, waterfall-type planning is a really stupid way of doing things. Okay, Sutherland, I can hear you saying, we're bad at estimating. But I've got to do something, right? I have to have some sort of plan. And you're right, you do. But the key is to refine the plan throughout the project rather than do it all up front. Plan in just enough detail to deliver the next increment of value and estimate the remainder of the project in larger chunks. In Scrum, at the end of each iteration, you have something of value that you can see, touch, and show to customers. You can ask them, is this what you want? Does this solve at least a piece of your problem? Are we going in the right direction? And if the answer is no, change your plan. So how do you do it? Let's talk about that wedding. The first thing is to create a list of all the things that make up a successful wedding. It might sound something like this. Bride and groom, flowers, invitations, church, reception hall, food, officiant, dress, wedding rings, music. Now the next thing to do is to take all those elements and sort them by priority. And that's going to be different for different people. Every bride and every groom sees the world differently. But I asked my friend Alex the other day how he prioritized his list, and this is the order he came up with. Bride and groom, officiant, wedding rings, reception hall, invitations, food, music, dress, flowers, church. The point of the exercise is to figure out the really important things and work on those first. For Alex, the food and music are more important than having the wedding in a church or the flowers. This is important data to have, because if you start bumping up against date or cost constraints, you know where to start cutting, at the bottom of the list. I'll get into more detail on this in Chapter 8, but that's probably enough for now. At Medco, the list wrapped around 3 walls of a large conference room and was hundreds of items long, with 6 different teams working on them. But the concept was entirely the same. Organized by value, whatever value that may be. It could be business value in the case of Medco, or it could be bride happiness value in the case of a wedding. Size does matter, but only relatively. So you have your list of stuff that needs to be done, and you've prioritized that list. Now the job is to figure out just how much effort, time, and money the project will take. As I've already pointed out, we humans are absolutely terrible at this. But what we are good at, it turns out, is relative sizing, comparing one size to another. Picking out the difference between small, medium, and large t-shirts, for example. My favorite example of relative sizing is dog points. Several years ago, a friend and one of the leading figures in agile thinking, Mike Cohn, was, like me, struggling with how to make his projects come in on time and on budget and how to estimate them. A dog lover, though his wife forbade him from getting a pooch, he started asking his teams what size of dog each piece of a project was. He'd list off a bunch of breeds like this. Labrador Retriever, Terrier, Great Dane, Poodle, Dachshund, German Shepherd, Irish Setter, Bulldog. And then he'd say, okay, this problem, is it a Dachshund or a Great Dane? And if that one is a Dachshund, this one must be about the size of a Labrador Retriever, right? And then the teams would go through all the features they had to develop and size them by dog. And then Mike would say, let's give each breed a number value. That'll be easier. Let's call a Dachshund a 1 and a Great Dane a 13. That would make a Lab a 5, say, and a Bulldog a 3. You could do the same thing with the wedding to-do list we just made. Finding a venue. Well, that's going to take some research, some pricing information, visiting the places. It's kind of involved. Let's call it a German Shepherd-size problem, a 5. Bride and groom, no problem. The two of us just have to show up. That's a Dachshund, a 1, just a phone call. Invitations, though, that is pretty involved. We have to make our list, get your mother's list, get my mother's list, pick out the stationery, have the invitations printed, hand-address them. That's a big project. That's a Great Dane, a 13, or maybe 2 Great Danes. And if something is that big, you should probably cut it down into manageable pieces. How about we make the gathering of the names one project and dealing with the printer another? Those are probably both the size of a bulldog, right? Call that a 3. The addressing, we'll call a German Shepherd a 5, and so on. So that's relative sizing, comparing tasks to one another. Now, we don't all use dogs, unfortunately, but you might have noticed a pattern there in the numbers I assigned. 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13. Each number in the series is the sum of the two previous numbers. It's called the Fibonacci sequence, and there's a reason we use it. It is everywhere. Fibonacci sequence, all around us. The sequence is how nature lays itself out, whether it be in the shell of a nautilus, the branches on a tree, the bumps on a pineapple, or the petals of a pine cone. It shows up in cauliflower and the curves of the human brain. It's the same whether you're looking at the curl of a fern leaf or the shape of a galaxy. It's one of those phenomena that, when you think about it, is pretty freaky. There's a name for this phenomenon. It's called the golden mean, or the golden ratio. We've built it into buildings and art. From the Parthenon in Athens to the Great Mosque of Karwan in Tunisia, we've used it to decide the size and shape of pages in a book and the proportions of playing cards. Humans are just programmed to find the ratios attractive. For our purposes, all that's important to know is that our species deeply understands the ratios of the Fibonacci sequence. We know them in our bones. The numbers in the Fibonacci sequence are far enough apart that we can easily tell the difference. It's easy for people to come down on one side or the other. If one person estimates something as a 5 and another as an 8, we can intuitively see the difference. But the difference between a 5 and a 6? That's pretty subtle, more than our brains can really register. It's fairly well known in medicine that for patients to report they perceive an improvement in a symptom, it has to have been a greater than 65% improvement. Our minds don't work in smooth increments. We're better at perceiving jumps from one state to another, and not smooth jumps, but jagged ones. What using the Fibonacci sequence to calculate task size permits is estimates that don't have to be 100% accurate. Nothing will be exactly a 5 or an 8 or a 13, but using those numbers gives us a way to collect opinions on the size of the task where everyone is using roughly the same measuring stick. And in that way, a consensus is formed. Estimating as a group in this manner gives us a far more accurate estimate than we could come up with alone. The Oracle of Delphi. So now we know we're good at comparing one thing to another, and we know the best ratio to utilize for the task. But how do we get there? A list of prioritized things to do is all well and good, but how do we figure out which story is a 5 and which is an 8, which is a Goldie and which is a Schnauzer? And even if one person has a pretty good idea, how do we make sure her estimates line up with everyone else's? What if she isn't taking some key factors into account? Unsurprisingly, this is not a new problem. People have struggled for decades with exactly this. One issue is that different members of the team know different things. But another is sometimes called the bandwagon effect. You've been in meetings like that. That's when someone comes up with an idea and everyone starts talking about it. And even if you disagreed with it initially, you go along because the group is going along. And everyone agrees on a path forward that seems like a really good idea at the time, but turns out to be a complete failure. And when you probe people about the decision, it's almost always the case that each had some reservations, but they didn't voice them because they figured everyone else was excited. People assume that if everyone else is going along with something, their own reservation is silly or misinformed, and they don't want to look stupid in front of the group. Remember, this groupthink isn't an individual failure. This is a human failure. In the literature, this effect has been explained as an informational cascade. As Sushil Bikchandani, David Hirschleifer, and Ivo Welch, the authors of the paper A Theory of Fads, Fashion, Custom, and Cultural Change as Informational Cascades put it, an informational cascade occurs when it is optimal for an individual, having observed the actions of those ahead of him, to follow the behavior of the preceding individual without regard to his own information. A great example the authors use is the submission of a paper to a journal. Let's say the first journal's editor rejects it. Then the writer submits the same article to a second journal. That journal's editor, learning of the first rejection, is more likely to reject it as well. And if there's a third journal, that editor, knowing of the two previous rejections, is even more likely to reject it. People assume other people are making sound judgments, even if those judgments contradict their own. This is bad. When you're making a judgment about when you'll likely deliver a multi-billion dollar project, or whether you'll get everything done on time for your wedding day, it's critical to apply your own judgment and use other estimates to improve your own, not replace it. The other well-known problem is what's called the halo effect. This is when one characteristic of something influences how people perceive other, unrelated characteristics. This was first empirically studied in 1920 by Edward Lee Thorndike. In his classic paper, A Constant Error in Psychological Ratings, Thorndike asked military officers to rank their soldiers by various qualities: physical, intellectual, leadership, personality, and so on. He then looked at how one set of qualities affected the rating of another. He found that they correlated too closely. If someone's physique was rated highly, so were his leadership skills, and his intelligence, and his character. This research has been supported in follow-up studies over the years, confirming that, for example, if someone is good-looking, everyone assumes they're also smart and trustworthy. But the halo effect extends to much more than mere physical beauty. It can crop up anywhere. Researchers point out, for example, that non-governmental organizations are often treated as forces for good, even if they aren't. That car companies will create one halo car to give a whole line a good impression. And that the Apple iPod gave all Apple's products a veneer of coolness. As with the bandwagon effect, people who are focused on the halo don't look at actual data. Rather, they gravitate towards something that has a positive sheen to it. Again, this isn't a failure of will. This is the nature of people. Fighting it head on is silly. It's like fighting gravity. But you can be clever about it. In the 1950s, the Rand Corporation was asked to answer some questions, the terrifying kind that got bandied about during the Cold War. Invoking in their terminology the Oracle of Delphi, the priestess who could predict the future, Norman Dahlke and Olaf Helmer published in 1963 a blandly titled paper, An Experimental Application of the Delphi Method to the Use of Experts, with the helpful reference, Memorandum RM727/1, abridged. In the paper, they declared their intention to pose questions without having one person's opinions affect those of another. So they gathered a group of experts, four economists, a physical vulnerability specialist, a systems analyst, and an electrical engineer. And they proposed to apply expert opinion to the selection from the viewpoint of a Soviet strategic planner of an optimal U.S. industrial target system and to the estimation of the number of A-bombs required to reduce the munitions output by a prescribed amount. Or to put it more simply, the idea was to ask how many nukes the Russians needed to stop us from making our own nukes. This was back when a nuclear conflict was seen as not only possible, but winnable. The thing is, Dahlke and Helmer, didn't want their experts to be influenced by one another. What if one was a department head at a big university and another a lowly faculty member at a small college? How to prevent one person's false assumptions from spoiling the opinions of others? What the two researchers did was conduct a series of anonymous surveys. None of the experts knew who the others were. They were just to give their estimates. After each questionnaire, the research duo would take the answers and data relied upon for those answers and feed it back to the group with any identifying characteristics stripped away. Rinse and repeat. So in the first questionnaire, the number of bombs needed to give a 50% confidence in the destruction of the U.S. arms industry was estimated to fall in a range from 50 at the low end to 5,000 at the high end. When Dahlke and Helmer analyzed the answers, it seemed that there were some commonalities in thinking. The vulnerability of various targets, the recoverability of various industries, initial stockpiles, and so on. They then asked the experts if that breakdown was correct and what other information they used in coming up with their answers. And they got back everything from how sturdy the factories were to the difference between physical and economic vulnerability to the lead time in manufacturing various components. Dahlke and Helmer then took that data, gave it to all the experts, and said, okay, now how many bombs? Now the range was between 89 and 800. Then they did it again and again. The results kept getting narrower. Eventually, the range was down to between 167 and 360 nuclear weapons needed. Being able to winnow an impossibly wide range of estimates from 10,000% to about 200% is an incredibly powerful capability for policymakers. It allows them to get a general expert consensus without worries of bias. This tool is so powerful that it is still used today by RAND. Just one recent example was a 2011 Delphi exercise looking at the conflict in Afghanistan and estimating the United States' chances of success. The outlook, if you're interested, was not great. Planning poker. So the advantage of Delphi is that it takes a broad array of opinions, attempts to remove as much bias as possible, and with informed yet anonymous statements, narrows down opinions into a generally accepted estimate. The bad part, for our purposes, is that it takes a long time. When I sat down with the teams at Medco, I didn't spend any time with anonymous surveys. I wanted all those hundreds of items estimated within hours, not days, and certainly not weeks. Fortunately, there is a way of gathering estimates that is fairly quick and accurate. It's called planning poker. The idea is simple. Each person has a deck of cards with those oh-so-interesting Fibonacci numbers on them, 1, 3, 5, 8, 13, and so on. Each item that needs to be estimated is brought to the table. Then everyone pulls the card they think represents the right amount of effort and puts it face down on the table. At the same time, everyone flips their cards over. If everyone is within two cards of each other, say a 5, 2 8s, and a 13, the team just adds them all up and takes the average, in that case 8.5, and moves on to the next item. Remember, we're talking estimates, not iron-bound schedules, and estimates on small pieces of the project. If people are more than three cards apart, then the high and the low cards talk about why they think what they do. Then everyone does another round of planning poker. Otherwise, they just average the estimates, which will approximate the numbers that the statisticians at the RAND Corporation came up with. Here's an example. Let's say you're painting the interior of a house, and you need to estimate how long it will take to paint the living room, the kitchen, and two bedrooms. And you're doing this with a team that you've painted rooms with before. So first, the two bedrooms. Everyone estimates those at a 3. No real disagreement. You've all done this before and see bedrooms as fairly straightforward. Then the team estimates the living room. It's a pretty big room, but fairly simple. People's estimates run from 5 to 13, eventually averaging 6. Again, no need for discussion. Then comes the kitchen, and there's a 3, an 8, a 13, and a 5 on the table. The person with the 3 argues that the room is pretty small, involving even less wall space than the bedrooms. The person with the 13 counters that the real-time sink is all the taping of cabinets and counters they'll have to do, and that painting all those small areas will have to be done with a brush, not with a roller. The team quickly lays down new cards. Now the 3 has become an 8, and everyone else stays the same. Close enough, they add them all up, average, and move on to the next task. This incredibly simple method is a way to avoid any kind of anchoring behavior, such as the bandwagon or halo effects, and it allows the whole team to share knowledge on a particular task. It's crucial, though, that you have the team who's actually doing the work do the estimating, not some expert ideal estimators. I learned this the hard way when I was working with an e-commerce company in Pennsylvania, GSI Commerce. They've since been bought up by eBay. What GSI does is design the online stores for such companies as Levi's, Toys R Us, Major League Baseball, and Zales Diamonds. These are not small projects, and GSI is pretty good at it. But GSI had the idea, which seemed like a good idea at the time, that instead of having each individual team do the estimates, they'd assign the task to the best estimators in the company, the smartest guys in the room who really understood the projects and the technology and knew what needed to be done. So they took some projects and estimated them. This one should take this much time, the next one that much, and so on. The plan was to deliver estimates for 80 multi-million dollar projects to both their clients and the teams that would actually do the work. This seems reasonable, right? Well, it turns out to be such a wrong way of going about things that they stopped the experiment halfway through after 40 projects were done. I was reminded of those drug studies that are halted because it turns out the drugs are killing the patients instead of curing them. The estimates were so far off, they were useless. Nothing was delivered on time, customers were unhappy, the teams were demoralized, it was a complete disaster. The managers went back to having the teams that would be doing the work also do the estimation. Lo and behold, the estimates once again started lining up with reality. What I took away from that was that only the people doing the work know how long and how much effort it will take. Maybe their team is really good at one kind of thing, but terrible at another. Maybe they have one expert who can be helpful in a particular area, but no one on the team knows about a different area. Teams, as I've discussed before, are individual and unique. Each has its own pace and rhythm. Forcing them into cookie-cutter processes is a recipe for disaster. There are no tasks, there are only stories. When you list things that need to be done, it's tempting just to put together a list as I did earlier about Alex's wedding. Church, flowers, officiant, food, so on. The problem is, if you give any of those items to a separate team that isn't intimately invested in the results of the decisions between white roses and daisies, you might not get the results you're looking for. How many times at work have you been given a job where you don't understand the reason you're doing it? Someone asks you to determine how much sales changed from month to month in Region A, looking at stores with more than 600 square feet. You do it, but you don't know why it needs to be done. And because of that, you might provide the wrong kind of data. You might misinterpret the question, or you might get resentful at being given a bunch of what seems like busy work. Or, if you're the manager, you might be astounded that your people don't understand immediately that you're looking at closing down small stores and opening up big ones. The problem is that you're not getting or giving enough information to actually do the job right. People think in narratives, in stories. That's how we understand the world. We have an intimate grasp of characters, desires, and motivations. Where we get into trouble is when we try to abstract out of the main through line discrete parts and deal with them out of context. So the first thing you want to think about when you're considering a task is character or role. For example, a customer, a bride, a reader, an employee. Who is this task being done for? Whose lens on the world is the one we need to gaze through when we're building this thing, making that decision, or delivering this piece? Then you need to think of the what. What we want done in the first place. This is usually where we start and stop, but it's only the middle of the process we should be following. Finally, you need to think of motivation. Why does this character want this thing? How is it going to serve and delight this particular customer? And in a way, this is the key part. Motivation colors everything. My favorite example of this comes from an internet meme from a few years back. It's simply a picture of Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the USS Enterprise, under which the text reads, "As a starship captain, I'd like the log function to automatically use today's stardate." It makes sense when you think about it. Haven't you wondered why in the far future a starship captain would have to state the date when he makes a log entry? Captain's log, stardate 4671.7. The planet Mars is lovely from orbit. We don't have to do that now when we make a blog entry. Why does he? But the key question not answered in that picture is why. Why does he want that functionality? What purpose will it serve? Is it just to keep entries in date order? Or is it more serious? Do those logs have to be unalterable to serve some sort of audit functionality by Starfleet crime scene investigators? Those are two very different implementations. One casual, one robust. The team needs to figure out what he really wants to do, at which point they might think of a wholly different way to do it. With more relevant information that the captain may not have even thought of, but that would be really useful. Often, needs will change with different characters. Imagine, for example, a story with the back two-thirds. I want a car so that I can drive to work. Now, if you start that sentence with, as a suburban commuter, versus, as a farmer in the South Dakota Badlands, you're going to end up with a very different interpretation of what the ideal vehicle is. So before you prioritize what needs to be done for your business, you need to define the character, the user, the customer, the person who's going to use what you're going to do. You need to know their likes, dislikes, passions, enthusiasms, frustrations, and joys, and then you need to understand their motivations. How do those character types feel about what they want? Why do they need a car? What are they going to do with that captain's log? This will also influence how you'll estimate things. Oh, they want a simple calendar function. That's easy. An unalterable timestamp for legal purposes? That's a bit trickier. Write short stories. When you're writing your stories, though, you want to make sure that they're small enough that you can actually estimate them. Imagine the story about Amazon.com. As a customer, I want the world's biggest online bookseller so that I can buy any book I want at any time I want. Now, that certainly encapsulates Amazon, but it's really too big to actually do anything with. You need to break it down, really down. You might write stories like these for an online bookstore. As a customer, I want to be able to browse books by genre so that I can find the type of books I like. As a customer, I want to put a book into a shopping cart so that I can buy it. As a product manager, I want to be able to track a customer's purchases so that I can market specific books to her based on past purchases. Those stories are ones that a team can wrap its head around. A discussion can actually ensue about how to implement them. They're specific enough to be actionable, but don't prescribe how they're going to be done. Remember, the team decides how the work will be accomplished, but what will be accomplished is decided by business value. The whole collection of stories that might make up that idea of an online bookstore is often referred to as an epic, a story too big to do by itself, but that includes a number of smaller stories that add up to a single idea. Tim Stoll is one of those guys whose career spans what might be called a broad spectrum of events with a focus on getting teams to get things done fast. He was a special forces medic who saw service in Iraq and Afghanistan, a CIA contractor, and a police officer whose job it was to go after violent felons. And now he's a scrum coach. He's always been a scrum coach, he says, even when he was leading special forces missions. In special operations, he says, we don't call them stories. We call them courses of action, but they're the same thing. Here's one of the few stories Tim can tell publicly about a special forces mission. A medical mission to Laos. We had two epics. The first was a medical course of instruction, training local forces on combat medicine. The second epic was a demining operation dealing with unexploded ordnance. As the medic, Tim was in charge of that first epic. He says that before the mission, he sat down and figured out what he needed to accomplish and how he should order the sub-stories. And, he says, he started with ideas that fall very easily into the Scrum framework. As a special forces medic, I must teach basic physiology to my students so they can understand the human body. Tim says that he knew he had to start there as he began writing his stories. His students had to understand where the bones were to do any sort of first aid. First, I teach long bones, then short bones, then wrists, ankles, tendons, ligaments. Only after the basic stories were covered could he get into setting those bones, clearing airways, and stopping bleeding. After writing those stories, he could see what he needed to support his teaching objectives. He needed a skeleton. He needed handouts in English and Laotian. And then he broke everything into iterations or sprints. 2 days flying to Laos, 1 week of setup, then 2 6-week iterations on instruction. We had to bring our students up from basic to EMT intermediate. And we did it. Be ready and be done. When you're writing stories or making a list of work to be done, it's important to ask 2 questions. Is the story ready? And how will you know when it's done? Let's take Tim's story as an example. As a special forces medic, I must teach basic physiology to my students so they can understand the human body. There's a mnemonic I always use to tell whether a story is ready. It was created by Bill Wake, who's a deep thinker on software design. Bill says that for any story to be ready, it needs to meet the invest criteria. Independent. The story must be actionable and completable on its own. It shouldn't be inherently dependent on another story. Negotiable. Until it's actually being done, it needs to be able to be rewritten. Allowance for change is built in. Valuable. It actually delivers value to a customer or user or stakeholder. Estimable. You have to be able to size it. Small. The story needs to be small enough to be able to estimate and plan for easily. If it is too big, rewrite it or break it down into smaller stories. Testable. The story must have a test it is supposed to pass in order to be complete. Write the test before you do the story. So Tim's story is independent. He can accomplish his mission without having to consider, say, the helicopter fuel it would take the students to get to the site. His story is negotiable. Teaching physiology is the story he thinks he needs to do. But if he gets there and finds out that the students already have this knowledge or part of this knowledge, he can change his teaching approach. It's valuable. The students will learn practical and applicable knowledge of the human body. It's small. It's basic anatomy, not how to do surgery, given the amount of anatomy he will be teaching. And it's testable. He knows the information he wants to impart, and he can give his students a test to see if they've actually learned the information. For each story pursued, there should be both a definition of ready, as in, does it meet the invest criteria? And finally, a definition of done, as in, what conditions need to be met? What tests need to be passed to call it a wrap? We find in real projects that if stories are really ready, the team will double the speed of implementation. And if the stories are really done at the end of a sprint, teams can double speed again. This is one of the tricks needed to get twice as much work done in half the time. Sprint planning. In Scrum, this kind of planning happens with each and every sprint at what is called the sprint planning meeting. Everyone gets together and looks at the list of stories that have to be done and says, okay, what can we accomplish this sprint? Are these stories ready? Can they be done by the end of this iteration? Can we then demo them to the customer and show real value? The key to answering those questions lies in just how fast the team is going. Know your velocity. We can finally start answering the question as to when things will be done because we now know how to measure what the team is actually doing. We have all these stories, these things that need to be done, and we've estimated them. This one is an 8, this one a 3, and so on. And then we start on our first sprint. Let's say it's a week long. At the end of the week, we count up all the stories we've completed, total the points they were estimated at, and that number tells us how fast the team is going, their velocity. And once you have a velocity, you can look at how many stories you have left and how many points they represent, and then you know when you'll be done. Also, once you have your velocity, you can figure out the most important thing in Scrum. What is keeping you from going faster? What is keeping you from accelerating? In the last chapter, I talked about waste, about the things that will slow you down. This is how you see if you really are getting rid of the waste. Let's go back to Medco, where we started this chapter. After we'd estimated all the work, I sat down with the senior management responsible for the project. There were several VPs who were general managers of business units and a senior VP. We sat down at the conference table, and that senior vice president had only one question. Will you meet the original date? He asked, slapping his hand on the table. I don't know, I said. But we'll beat the revised date your people came up with, or you can get your money back.
That's not good enough. Will you meet